And we are back here on Unusual Sources 93.3 CFMU FM, bringing you the news from Hamilton around the world, right here in Hamilton at 93.3 CFMU FM and live streaming at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And I'm very pleased to be bringing with us today Lynn Adamson. She is co-chair of the Canadian Voice of Women for Peace, which you can find at vowpeace.org. That's vowpeace.org. Lynn has been a participant in the Canadian boat to Gaza. She's a Quaker. In 2009, she passed a resolution on Israel and Palestine that called for an end to the occupation and an end to the siege and for supporting nonviolent initiatives. So, Lynn, I wanted to thank you very much for being on the program with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Listen, just the list of things you've been involved with on its own is very impressive. But your organization is also a name that's come up. We've been doing continuous coverage of this unprecedented assault on Gaza for the last 3 or 4 weeks. And Gaza's Ark has been a feature on this program. And we've always been impressed by the activities of Voices of Women for Peace. I just wanted to see if maybe you could let our listeners know a little bit about what the organization does.
We were founded in 1960, and we were founded to act for nuclear abolition. So we worked very hard on that to get partial test ban treaty. And then we looked at confronting the idea of the enemy. So people visited Russia during the Cold War and visited Vietnam and had visitors from there during the Vietnam War. And we've just tried to do that kind of outreach across boundaries for the entire time that we've been active. And we also take women to the United Nations every year for the special session on women, and that's in February or March of the year. And we also do a summer camp for young women leaders, peace leaders. That'll be happening mid-August, 16th and 17th. People can get information on all these activities on our website. And coming up this fall, we're going to have our AGM in November on climate change and conflict, the extremely serious issue we're looking at right now.
Your organization seems to be very impressive scope to your activities.
Yes, we do, and it's an entirely volunteer organization, and we invite women from across Canada to get involved. We do have chapters in Nova Scotia. We have an active chapter in Winnipeg, in Nelson, B.C., and Salt Spring Island. We have active members across the country in various places, and including some in Hamilton and in Toronto, of course. So we do invite women to get involved, and because it's great working together on these issues, it's important to work together and to have our voice out there. I think women have a very special voice, and we like to encourage women to help develop the skill in speaking out as well. So we do a lot of active letter writing and lobbying of our government, and right now we have sent a letter, which people can find on our website, to our government and the opposition leaders about the situation in Gaza and the essential need to get to the root causes, to end the siege on Gaza, to give people a future, to settle the issues, to give justice to Palestinians as well as Israelis. It'll be better future for everyone if we're not having people be killed. And so much damage, there's billions of dollars in infrastructure damage and 1,900 deaths. And those deaths include young people in Gaza who were becoming peacemakers, active with American Friends Service Committee, with other peace-building groups that have programs in Gaza, and they've been killed, and their families have been killed. It's so much damage to have to recover from, and we know that war is not the answer. War is never the answer. We know that there's an alternative path that has to do with using our resources to meet human needs and to meet environmental needs. So that is the way to look to the future. We want to have a positive approach, and that is what we focus on.
Yes, it must be awful seeing what's happening in Gaza, given you may know some of the people who are there, either as solidarity activists or people living in Gaza. You've been involved, as has your organization, in a lot of nonviolent activity. I think one of the most prominent was the Canadian boat to Gaza. Could you tell me how you became involved in that?
Yes, I became involved in that in part because Sandra Roosh, our coordinator of Voice of Women for Peace, is involved in that and now in Gaza's Ark, and she invited me to apply to be involved in that. And so approximately 30 people were selected to be on that boat. And we were part of a freedom flotilla that was attempting to end the siege on Gaza and bring aid supplies in and try to establish that the harbor could be used. Right now, your listeners may not know, but if people go out to the harbor deep enough to actually fish, they get shot at by the Israelis. That harbor is not allowed to be used and hasn't been for decades. And we just think that they have to be able to have an above-ground economy so that this below-ground economy through the tunnels doesn't have to be there. Right now, people need to use those tunnels for essential supplies as well as for the weapons that come through. But the people do not have the alternative of building a peaceful economy and a future-oriented economy based around their needs and around trade with the world and connections with the world. It's like an open-air prison, and people have to realize how densely populated it is. It's half the size of Toronto, but in a long, thin strip. And, you know, you've got 1.8 million people crowded into that. Most of them are refugees from 1948 when they lost their homes in what is now the State of Israel. And people may not know, your listeners may not know either, that Israel does not have established boundaries, that Israel has occupied the West Bank and Gaza since 1967, and that the Gaza, they say they're not occupying it, however, they control all the borders, and they have these incursions, of which this latest assault is way much more extreme than the usual, but they control the Gaza Strip completely. And what the Palestinians are asking for is to have, there's 10 points in their ceasefire expectations, and it's primarily around open borders and having the UN run those rather than Israel. So having an independent third party, which would be United Nations, to be monitoring what comes and goes from Gaza and who comes and goes from Gaza rather than Israel controlling it. And if Israel is really done with their occupation of Gaza, that would be an excellent next step. But unless there's pressure, international pressure, put to bear on Israel, they're really unlikely to actually deal with the root causes. They're unlikely to stop the expansion of settlements in the West Bank, which is really, it's taking away from any possibility of the two-state solution that people like to talk about, because there just wouldn't be enough land to have a viable second state. It's really wonderful if people could have the opportunity to go there and see firsthand what it's like living under the occupation. In 2004, I spent the summer in the West Bank and saw how life was. I saw segregated roads. I saw bulldozing of olive trees, of homes, and I saw the night raids on families, the detention of young children, and the shooting up of towns at night to kind of stimulate. It seems like you think, what are they doing? And it's almost like they want to trigger violence. But there's been a huge amount of nonviolence activity going on in the West Bank. A number of communities have resisted the taking of their land by the wall that Israel has built into the West Bank, taking nearly 10% of the land in the West Bank. And they've resisted that nonviolently in many communities. There's a community called Budrus. There's a film made about their struggle many months, and they managed to get the root of the wall moved back so they could keep some of the land for their village and their village intact. But it's very, very difficult and challenging for Palestinians to win through nonviolence. But people need to know that the vast majority of the resistance is nonviolent. We just don't hear about it in our media very much.
That's right. There's so many activities. I mean, you've seen some of them from the outside, like the Canadian boat to Gaza, some of the sit-ins that occur. The Palestinians, what I get from your extensive knowledge and description of the situation here is that Palestinians have had their options removed. You know, their land borders are cut off. The sea borders are cut off by Israel, who have forbidden them to use those waters. And, you know, we've tried to get around that in peaceful and constructive ways in Canada by supporting projects like Gaza's Ark, building, you know, trade vessel inside Gaza. And of course, these activities are stymied. Gaza's Ark was
Gaza's Ark was bombed in this recent assault on Gaza. It was bombed, and all that's left is the name, the remnants of that boat. Because I don't believe they are genuine in wanting to move forward, that current state of Israel, that is to say, I think that there are people in Israel who would like to see a settlement, but I don't think it's going to happen without immense international pressure, because their internal pressure of right-wing politics and land acquisition is really driving that, and the willingness to to be violent. I did hear that somewhat like 90% of people in Israel were supporting the assault on Gaza because they're told what a threat Hamas is. But they're not told that there was a unity government formed by Hamas and Fatah in June, and they put out a proposal that they negotiate together, and Hamas was going to step back from all their positions and let the PA, which is run by Fatah, which is much more moderate, you'd never hear of anything in the West Bank, any kind of violence from Palestinians. They do all nonviolent resistance there. And so they were going to change that over, and that's when the conditions were set for this assault. What happened is after there were two Palestinians who were executed, young Palestinians just walking in the street, just shot in the back, and there's videos of these killings in May. And then there were the three Israeli boys who were abducted and killed. Very tragic, because they all were tragic. We heard much, much more about that. In fact, we didn't hear about the Palestinian boys in May at all. And then there was the Palestinian boy burned alive. That's when we did hear about. But what we didn't hear about was the raids that went on in the West Bank. Like, it was collective punishment, which is against international law, rather than treating the deaths of these boys as criminal acts and cooperating together in finding out who was responsible and prosecuting them. It was blamed on Hamas, and it was part of a huge buildup. They swept through the West Bank, arrested hundreds of people, and terrorized communities in supposedly looking for the boys, when they in fact knew, evidence says now, that the boys had already been killed.
Yes. Well,
so, you know, it's just, and then Hamas is so-called starting the war. It people are missing a whole big piece of it, and I understand how people don't understand the picture if they just listen to the mainstream news. TheRealNews.com has some excellent segments on the history with Israel and Palestine, including one on the military trade between Canada and Israel. There's quite a lot of that. That's worth watching. And to try to understand what's going on behind the scenes, it doesn't get talked about in our news, our mainstream news.
Yes. It always seems to be the case in our media that the story starts with Hamas firing rockets. It doesn't mm-hmm. talk about Israel going in incursions into Palestinian territory prior to that, you know, with the giant search, arresting people and so on. A lot of the commentary on social media, as well as on sites like Mondo Weiss, have been looking at how the Israeli authorities had a much better knowledge of what had happened to those Israeli teenagers than they indicated. There was a suppression of news, and what they did was precisely, as you say, use that as a build-up to launch a massive campaign against Gaza.
Yes, when in fact you could send the message to the population that these are criminal acts, they're terrible, we want to find the people responsible and prosecute them, and not demonize Hamas. And I mean, it's not like I love Hamas and that I love, you know, their rockets. I don't, like none of us do. It's just that it's a tiny part of what's going on there. And Israel acts like publicly, like it can all be blamed on Hamas, like they have no agency to do anything else. And I know there's an alternative path, and they need to go down that path. And the rest of the world, and I think John Kerry is trying to pressure them to actually end that siege right now in these talks that they're having, this ceasefire, temporary ceasefire. And honestly, if the people of Gaza don't get something out of this in terms of a lifting of the siege, it's just a very hopeless situation for them there. They're not getting enough calories even to eat, to live on. They're not getting the aid they need. They're not allowed things like cement and concrete for reconstruction. So you think about everything that's been destroyed. How can it be rebuilt? They really need a breath of fresh air. They need to be able to move. Amira Haas is a wonderful journalist with Haaretz, and she has written a good, really good column on what they need and give them a chance to breathe and give them a chance to have a future to look forward to. In a world that they can connect to and relate to, and not have it be a prison. So I think those are really important things. And I wanted to say, too, that it's very important to look forward. I come from a background in conflict resolution and peace building, and we look at the past in order to understand kind of where we're at now. However, our main purpose is not to be assigning blame. It's like, what positive steps can be taken forward now? Like, how can we build a positive future where human needs are addressed, where environmental needs are addressed? And that's very much the approach that we take in our organization, Voice of Women for Peace. How can we move forward in a positive direction? How can we be involved how can we encourage women as peace builders to be involved? And so it's been really great to work with many wonderful women, including the 3-day sit-in that we just had on the sidewalk at the consulate, sleeping over and vigiling for 3 days to try to show them that people are very upset with the policies that they're operating on now, and that we want to see a change, and to tell our own government that we want to see a change.
That was Toronto, right?
That was in Toronto, yes.
So you had a sit-in at the Israeli consulate for 3 days.
Yes, we did. We were on the sidewalk. We didn't try to get in the consulate inside, but we slept out and we vigiled outside. We talked to everybody going by, and we had a pretty good reception. We gave out information, and we talked. We did get some media coverage, some interviews on CP24 and other interviews that came along, and I think it was a really important witness. We feel it was a very important witness to do, and we see that people are doing sit-ins and other actions all around the world, and I think we should not underestimate the impact of this. That civil society voice is very powerful. You've seen, even in Britain, the foreign minister stepped down because it was so unhappy with the British stand, her own government that she's part of, their stand on support of Israel. And you know, people need to see moral courage in order to be inspired to take moral courage and to change the way, the direction we're going, and we've got to have some moral courage.
Yes, absolutely.
They were going.
We've seen some very inspiring actions in Great Britain, for example, as you say, not just figures stepping down, but there's been occupations of factory producing weapons for Israel, for example.
That's right, and there is a call, and there's even an Avaaz petition online people can find to call for an embargo on arms going to Israel would be an enormously positive step. The resupply of Israel, like the United States says they're not really happy with what's been going on, but they still send weapons and ammunition and restock all that equipment without any, like Israel is never get any consequences. Israel has to experience consequences, and I'm talking about the state of Israel if it's going to become accountable to international law. It's really painful to watch a situation where international law is being flaunted when we have international law and it's supposed to help guide the way we go. And there are the countries that have been cut off from their arms shipments when they were attacking their own citizens, including most recently Egypt. However, we don't see that kind of response for Israel, and I think that that's because we don't yet have enough of a groundswell of public opinion saying, we don't want this special treatment for Israel. They've got to be accountable and responsible too, and we're going to hold them to it.
Yes, Israel says it's a Western democracy, and many people have said, well, we should hold you to those standards. There's a lot of attention on every single thing you've mentioned, the U.S. Yeah. weapon shipments to Israel, which were shipped to them in the middle of this current bombardment, for example,
exactly.
You know, which killed 1,800 people. Those deaths, you could say, are on Obama's hands, the way he accuses other foreign leaders of having blood on their hands. You know, it's a possibility.
Yes.
And so I think
these are criminal acts in the U.N., the targeting of, I think, 8 different U.N. Institutions in Gaza, even though they knew where they were and they could have avoided them, but they were bombed, and people who'd been forced out of their own homes were now being bombed in the places that they'd taken shelter. That is a criminal act. That is a war crime, and that should be tried in International Criminal Court, and anyone who supports it, including, as you say, Obama, really does have blood on their hands. Certainly our government does because of our complicit. We were actually the first government to say we wouldn't talk to Hamas when they were democratically elected in 2005, they're so-called terrorists. Well, you know, don't you think the bombs falling from Israel are terrorism? They're terror-creating? The selective use of that term and the unwillingness to sit down. I mean, they're sitting down with them now, so why couldn't they have sat down with them years ago or months ago and avoided this horrible crime that's gone on and all these deaths, which only creates more bitterness and anger and more barriers for the future? Like, now the civil society is now expected to fundraise billions of dollars to rebuild and to restore the relationships that have been so damaged and destroyed. Why is it really, I really resent it that we're expected to go and raise that money now when they've done all the bombing and they're getting their weapons.
Yes, and they get $3 billion in one year, for example, from the United States. You know, the U.S. has funded Israel more than it's funded entire continents over the last 30 years. And we know where that money goes. It goes to weapons, it goes to settlements, and it goes to occupation. As far as those sanctuaries that were bombed go, I'm not sure if anyone has ever attacked as many United Nations posts and installations as Israel did in this current campaign.
No.
It is, they're they're just waving their nose at the United Nations at this point.
It says that they're sending a message to people that you are subjugated and you are not supposed to be asking for anything, and just be quiet and don't bother us ever. When in fact, I think those missiles are kind of a sign to the world that please pay attention. We cannot exist this way. You know, we cannot live this way. And I don't justify them or any violence. I really don't. But I think we've got to understand that the conditions there do not allow for people to picture a future. And that's what we need. And that's what we need in around the world. We've got to focus on peace building and put our resources in that direction. And dealing with the environmental crisis, the real crises that we have to face. We've got to cooperate together to deal with those and not waste resources and create such destruction with our tax dollars.
Yes.
We're in charge of where our tax dollars go. There's a Department of Peace initiative in Canada that people might be interested in that's saying we need to have a policy in Canada and the resources in Canada directed to peace building. It's an excellent program. And we're just looking for a government that would take that kind of approach forward.
Yes, we need to put pressure on our politicians. They're actually out of sync with the rest of the world. You have members of the United Kingdom Conservative Party stepping forward to oppose the bombardment of Gaza and saying, why are we supporting this? Why are we giving weapons to Israel? We need to see more of that in Canada. Actions like your sit-in are very helpful in bringing attention to this. And just because we're at a temporary ceasefire right now doesn't mean that this situation is over. And, you know, I could talk about that, but basically it's not over for the people in Gaza if there's a 72-hour or 1 week or 1 month or 1 year ceasefire. We have a lot of work to do, and people can go to Voices of Women for Peace at vowpeace.org. They can look up Gaza's Ark and other initiatives. But before we go, you know, you talked about these other initiatives and other programs. Very briefly, could you tell us about the what's just happened today with regard to Hiroshima Day and looking at victims of nuclear war here in Canada?
Yes, we have actions that are happening today. Ours is at City Hall at in Toronto at 6:45, commemoration of Hiroshima Day. There is a drumming, there's a lot of ceremony as well as the speeches, and then there will be lantern lighting. And so it's a kind of a family-level celebration, like includes everyone outdoors, and really is a kind of deeply reflective experience to remind us that we have between 10 and 15,000 nuclear weapons still in this world, and capable of creating even more damage. Well, many of them are like 1,000 times as powerful as what was dropped on Hiroshima. They're just sitting around the planet. They haven't yet been dismantled, and we know that nuclear weapons can never be used. They should all be dismantled, and that is one of the campaigns that we're also working on. So, yeah, Hiroshima Day is a very important day to remember the destruction that nuclear weapons can create.
Absolutely. Listen, you had so much to tell us. People should listen to this interview again. I'll give them directions to do that. But thank you so much. This was absolutely a fact-packed interview. So I wanted to thank you once again for being on our program.
You're
today.
Very welcome. And I'll encourage everyone to show up on, I believe it's the 10th this weekend, there'll be demonstrations around the world in support of a future for people in Gaza.
Okay. Thanks very
thank
much.
You. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And that was Lynn Adamson, Voices of Women for Peace. And, of course, Hamilton is having its demonstration this Saturday, August 9th, 1 p.m. at Hamilton City Hall. That's August 9th, 1 p.m., Hamilton City Hall. Go to www.hamiltoncoalitiontostopthewar.ca. That's Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. You can get the information for that protest, and you can also get a digital copy of this interview in a few days. So thanks very much for listening, and until next week, take care.